will be a jubilee for you. During that year, you must not plant your fields or store away any crops that grow on their own. And don't gather the grapes from your unpruned vines. It will be a jubilee year for you, and you must keep it holy. But you may only eat whatever the land produces on its own. In the year of Jubilee, each of you may return to your land that belonged to your ancestors. When you make an agreement with your neighbor to buy or sell property, you must not take advantage of each other. When you buy land from your neighbor, the price you pay must be based on the number of years since the last Jubilee. The seller must set the price by taking into account the number of years remaining until the next year of Jubilee. The more years until the next Jubilee, the higher the price. The fewer years, the lower the price. After all, the person selling the land is actually selling you a certain number of harvests. Show your fear of God by not taking advantage of each other. I am the Lord your God. If you want to live securely in the land, follow my decrees and obey my regulations. Then the land will yield large crops, and you will eat your fill and live securely in it. But you must ask, what will we eat during the seventh year, since we are not allowed to plant or harvest crops that year? Be assured that I will send my blessing for you in the sixth year. So the land will produce a crop large enough for 3 years. When you plant your fields in the eighth year, you will still be eating from the large crop of the sixth year. In fact, you will still be eating from that large crop when the new crop is harvested in the ninth year. The land must never be sold on a permanent basis, for the land belongs to me. You are only foreigners and tenants, farmer workers for me. With every purchase of the land, you must grant the seller the right to buy it back. If one of your fellow Israelites falls into poverty and is forced to sell some family land, then a close relative should buy it back from him. So ends the reading of the word. May the Lord add a blessing to the reading.
All right, the children are dismissed for children's church. Okay, so I know that is a long scripture out of most people's least favorite book of the Bible, and we're going to get to that, and I think that this is actually one of the most fascinating and radical pieces of scripture in the Old Testament, and perhaps even in the entirety of the Bible. But I'm going to put a pin in it right here. Today we, as you probably noticed, are going to be discussing Jubilee, or the theme of Jubilee in the Bible, and we're talking about freedom. And what does it mean to be called out? We're talking about freedom, and what does it mean to be called out in light and in reflection on the realities of human trafficking and modern-day slavery and sexual violence in our world. These are tough topics, I want to acknowledge really quick. They're tough topics to acknowledge that they're in our world. They're tough to acknowledge that they probably affected each and every one of our family systems and family histories at some point. Something that's very painful to talk about. When you talk about human trafficking, or my experience of talking about human trafficking or modern day slavery, is people like line up right behind you and say, "Oh yeah, jolly go, we're right behind you on that." And the second you start talking about what goes into the systems that create modern day slavery and human trafficking, that's when people start backing off and say, "Whoa, whoa, 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 you got to be too big of a deal for me here. I didn't sign up for this." When you start talking about some of the root causes, some of the root spiritual and cultural influences of human trafficking and modern day slavery, that's when people usually back out of the conversation. So I just want to say that right here, and I want to ask you this morning, is there something new in your heart? Does God have something new in your heart to say to you regarding these tough, difficult issues? Is there a new pain that you need to acknowledge somewhere? Is there a new place where you need healing? Is there a new place where you can use your voice for freedom? First, I want to I want to talk about what does this these words called out for freedom mean. Tell me real quick, does anyone know what one of the original or one of the oldest words for church is? It's ekklesia is the original word. And it's actually a compound word that in some ways has nothing to do or say about what church is. It has the word ek, which means out of or from. It's where you get the ex in Exodus, which you're like, okay, so that sounds really, really profound. Ek and out or from. And then the other word is laos, which means a body, a community of people, a congregation. This is where we get the group, the designation laity, as in a whole body, a whole group of the people of the church coming together. The two words put together, ekklesia, means called out ones. That we as the church are the people who are called out for the gospel of God. That either God has called us or we have set ourselves aside to be people of God's kingdom in our world. That we have put, that we are attempting to put ourselves aside to proclaim, to enact, and to designate who God is in our world. This is one of the most fundamental aspects of who we are to be as the people of God, as the people of the church. And for freedom is another interesting word. We often like to talk in our political day and age of political freedom, right? The ability for people like me to yap about whatever I want. Yap, 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 yap. Or to go where places where I want. Maybe being able to have rights to specific goods or specific things, or specific services. To not have to carry, a big one is not having to carry my papers with me every single place that I go. You know, there are plenty of places in the world that if you don't have your place, your papers with you, you can end up in a whole lot of trouble really quick on any given day of the week or at any given time. That your papers have to be close to you wherever you go at any time. And if you don't have papers, you can end up very, very quickly at the mercy of a very merciless law. But I don't want to talk about this political form of freedom today. Instead, I believe that there is a deeper form and a deeper understanding of what freedom at its core really is. See, in our world, I think as most of us can acknowledge, there is sin and there is brokenness. There is stuff that makes relationships work right and brings relationships and people into destructive habits. And as much as we try, as much as we do really cool and interesting things, almost everyone we encounter is on some journey of getting away from the destruction in our world. Whether you're seeking a journey away from that destruction in some form of behavior, or being a part of one group of people or another, or in the midst of a hobby, or in the midst of a relationship. But these still don't offer the freedom from the hurt and the brokenness that we can find, right? They don't offer the freedom from the damage of these broken relationships, of this hurt, of these hurting relationships in the world. Instead, what we believe as free Methodists is that the truest freedom that we can find is in relationship with Jesus. Because in relationship with Jesus, we find that we can be in a life-giving way of life. That we don't have to live into the destruction-giving ways of life. That we are free to live in life-giving ways. You can have a life that brings life, not that brings hurt. You can have a life that brings reconciliation to those broken areas in our world around us. You can bring life everywhere around you. This is what we mean when we talk about freedom. In the midst of freedom, though, we must acknowledge the reality and the pain of such slavery and such sin that exists in the world, of such death-giving and dark-giving hurt and behaviors and ways of doing things, in hopes that we can find the way of God's liberation. The first story of freedom that we can find in our story that we can find in the history of the church, that we can find in the Bible or the people of God, the story we can find in our own lives, I think, is a story of a 10-round cage fight, MMA style, with all no holds barred, between God and the entire pantheon of Egypt. Every single one of them, God showing, you do not have the power to bring true life. You do not have sovereignty, true sovereignty of all. And the people of God witnessed as God, with God's own right hand and strong arm, beat down kind of viciously and a little meanly every single one of this Egyptian pantheon. And even in the end, brings destruction by the waters of the Red Sea upon Egypt's leader. For no conventional power can, even conventional system of idols, can stand anything against the creative power of God. And this is where Tony talked about this last week. This is where Exodus 15, the Song of Moses, as it's called by commentators, comes into play. It is to celebrate how God has delivered each and every one of us out of terrible situations. Where has God delivered you from bondage in your life? And where does more deliverance need to come? Do you have the trust to believe that that deliverance is coming for you? Can that spirit of deliverance be upon your life? This is the song of Moses, for us to remember how God has delivered us. But it's also to point out the problem of idols in almost any situation, and the problems of idols in any culture. The whole book of the Bible is like imprinted with the problem of idolatry. That idols are a problem because they bring us into a false relationship with who the Creator is. We get a false understanding of who the Creator is. And when we have a false understanding of who the Creator is, we have a false understanding of creation. And if we have a false understanding of creation, then we have a false understanding of people created in the image of God, the Creator. And that kind of leads to the dark side, to give you your Star Wars reference for the day. And this is why all of the Bible really gets bent out of shape about this whole idolatry thing. But it goes a step further. This idolatry thing can work into the lives, into the hearts of the people of God. And it can work into anyone's life. Doesn't matter their circumstances. Idolatry can sneak in. There can be idols in the dark that even the people of God don't know that they are worshiping. And that's what makes these idols so dangerous, the idols in the dark. If we are honest, if the people of God are honest with ourselves, like the Bible is honest with itself, then we have to be on guard and honest about how idolatry can work into our lives and our hearts. I talk about this idolatry problem because I've learned a lot about human trafficking and a lot about modern-day slavery over the last few years. I've gone into some pretty shady parts of town and some pretty shady situations. And I've tried to talk with a number of experts, both in town and in different parts of the world, getting to know their stories, getting to know what has happened. And one of the things that's fascinating about, it's fascinating and terrifying about modern-day slavery and human trafficking is that everywhere you go, it's a little bit different. There's a different maladaptive path through which people find themselves in this terrible situation. This terrible situation that is fundamentally violent and fundamentally against the human vocation, the human call of who we are. There isn't just like one single way it all happens. If there was all one single way, you could just bar off that one single way of it all happening. But no, in different contexts, it happens differently. In different cultures, it happens differently. Yet there are 40 million people who live in modern-day slavery today. If you don't remember the number of how much 40 million is, 38 million people is the number of people who live in the world's largest metropolitan area, which is Tokyo. It means there's 2 million more people in slavery today than there are people in the world's biggest city. That should be a scary number to us. And that doesn't even count. That's actually a low bar estimate by many. That doesn't even count the hundreds of thousands of women and children who find themselves in situations of human trafficking. This is a really scary number. And as far as we know, it's in almost every country and every community on the globe. It's scary. It's terrifying. It happens differently everywhere. But in every one, so far as I figured out so far, in almost every one of these, there is some idol in the dark that is crawling. Some idol in the dark that is working. That people don't know that this idol is there. People don't know that this idol is controlling people's actions or that they're even worshiping it at all. That they're even practicing this idol. This is what makes this idolatry so complicated and so completely destructive. It's destructive to who we are as human beings and who we are called to be. N.T. Wright has this thing that he says. He says that you become what you worship. If you don't know what you're worshiping, you don't know what you're becoming. And if you're going to worship something false, then you will become something false. You become what you worship. The most painful part for us to admit when we talk about modern-day slavery, when we talk about human trafficking, is that there's usually underneath the surface cultural trends and cultural aspects of our system that kind of like help take one little microcosm of a step in legitimizing it. Legitimizing in how we devalue and mistreat other people. And how we treat people not in the way God or not in the way Jesus calls us to treat them. When we objectify people, in particular when we objectify women, we engage in some kind of idolatry of some kind. If you like Netflix TV shows, there's this Netflix TV show you probably shouldn't watch and actually has a pretty sketchy history in and of itself called House of Cards. And I've only seen a few episodes, but in one of the early episodes, there's a really scary character who kind of freaks the skin out of me named Frank Underwood. Frank Underwood has a quote about corruption and sex, and he's actually a very corrupt guy who's power hungry, and says that sex isn't about love or intimacy, sex is about power. Yeah, really gross, right? Really gross. But in situations where women there's sexual objectification of some kind, that is usually what sex is about, right? Is it becomes about power. It becomes about gaining an object. This is hard stuff, right? I can see some of your faces. You're like, oh, I don't want to go any deeper in this conversation. Can I tune out yet? Get to the good stuff, man. This is hard stuff to talk about. The hashtag MeToo movement points this out to all of us. The prevalence of sexual violence there is all over the world, and especially in our culture, there are a lot of people, in many cases men who have power and who are white. Oh no, that have the means to instantly escape or get out of dodge. If they have perpetuated sexual violence in some kind. And then what's even worse about this fancy social media hashtag is some of it's pointed at the church. Some of it's pointed at pastors, at theologically educated white men, oh shoot, who have power or who are in places of leadership that can get out of dodge, that can make a system where they don't have to face the music when they sexually violate another human being. This is scary stuff. There have been a number of studies that have been going on for years of what happens in these kinds of systems. What happens that a leader who is supposed to be a person of God or supposed to be a great leader of a corporation, whatever it is, how they can get away with this kind of mistreatment of other human beings. And almost all the time, it goes hand in hand with some form of autocratic leadership. What I mean by that is some kind of leadership where there's a leader who says, "What I say is the word of law," in the midst of a community. And that creates a lot of harm. Now, once I figured that out, that autocratic leaders almost always create a system of sexual violence, it's like easy to spot, right? You can be like, over there's going to be a problem. It might not be right now, but it's going to be there at some point. there is going to be some kind of sexual violence. And studies show that sexual violence and autocratic leadership frequently go hand in hand. They are like somehow spiritually tied to each other. It's like some weird thing where sex becomes about power, which is freakishly wrong, and proves Frank Underwood's point, which is like freaky creepy. And it shows us that there's an idol in the dark. Race also almost always factors in somewhere when we're talking about human trafficking and slavery and sexual violence. White, educated men, more people are frequently going to believe those people, whoever they are, in a court of law or in front of a bunch of lawyers or in front of a bunch of institutions than they are a person of color, in particular women of color. Even though numerous studies have found that women of color are statistically far more likely to have sexual violence in their history than white women. People of color frequently are sexually mistreated or have sexual violence against them far more often than white people, and they aren't believed about it. There's an idol in the dark right there, right? It's terrible. And all of these breed slavery and bondage. It's the deepest kind of internal hurt that I think someone can have. It's a practice of a poor understanding of God's creation. For us today, I think it's really powerful for us to simply name what kind of idol there might be in the dark. Even if you're talking to someone who doesn't believe in God at all, you can pretend you're really cool and do like name dropping, be like, "Huh, that sounds like something Dionysus would be really into. Huh, that sounds like something Tiamat would really love to do in your life." And people are going to be like, "What's that?" And you can be like, "Well, Dionysus is the Greek god of totally out of control and getting so slobbered that you don't have to worry about what your actions are." Or just name, "I think there's an idol of power behind that door that you're not looking into." A lot of power for us can simply be naming what is the idol that's at work. Say, what's the thing behind the thing that people are chasing? And is that the thing behind the thing that you want to be following? This is a place where we have to shine like a light. We have to shine like a light on the hill into a world that has deep hurt and deep brokenness. We have to be people of the Creator who created us in righteousness, who created us in the image of God, and take that image of God out into the world, restoring people to that image. We must free people from the bondage and the hurt of this violence in the world and give them the opportunity to be in a life-giving way. We must break the chains that hold others. Idols don't just hold you hostage. One person in power can have an idol that holds others hostage. This brings us to Leviticus 25, what I think is one of the most radical and super cool texts of the Old Testament. If you're reading it literally, Leviticus 25 says that every 7 years, a farmer in particular, is to have a year or a season of rest for all of their workers, a season of connecting with God. Please tell me, quick pop quiz real quick, what is the number 7 associated with in the Bible? Sabbath. What is Sabbath? Day of rest. Where do we get that day of rest? It's found in God, in the story of creation, where God's self takes the time to rest and connect with all the goodness and awesomeness that there is in creation. And this is the same commandment to us, that we are to have times of rest, to communicate, to commune, to be revitalized by the Creator. And this revitalization is key to who we are called to be as human beings. It is key to the human vocation. Then after that holy time of rest, there are going to be seven more holy times of rests. That there are more times of holy rests than just once. That it's a rhythm you engage in continually. And then after seven of those holy rests, I guess that's kind of supposed to be a holy number there, that you're going to celebrate that year and the year afterward, and you're going to have the Jubilee where you set all of the captives free in the land. Set everyone who is bondage free in the land. Now, this is the part where people get hung up. They think literally every 50 years is when people are supposed to be free. But no, this isn't what this text argues at all. We've already talked about the number of rest. But seven rests is also supposed to be a holy number. It's supposed to be a holy time of holiness. It's supposed to be like an extra super duper time of Sabbath, of holy time communion with God. And after that very holy communion with God, we come to a place of completion. A place of it is finished. Or what the Bible will normally associate with the number 50. Where does 50 show up in the Bible? Oh, I got you on this one, guys. It's Pentecost. The number 50 is associated with the coming of God's instruction, and it's associated with the coming of God's Spirit. Of God's Spirit coming down on the people of God, empowering them. That the Spirit of God is close to us and near to us after it is finished, after the atonement happens. Come on, guys, you're following me with this one, right? Now, there's a pretty obvious thing about the "it is finished" line. Just as there's a pretty obvious thing, who is the fella, who is the high priest who blows the ram's horn on the 50th year? Boom! That Jesus is our high priest, right? This is just something they share all the time out of the book of Hebrews. That Jesus is our high priest. And that Jesus is the one who blows this ram's horn. That it's out of the work of Jesus, out of the holy communion with Jesus, that we find the power for Jubilee in our lives. But you know what? Jesus doesn't do it alone. The high priest can't just sit there by himself blowing the horn. No, there's got to be people who also have ram's horns that blow that ram's horn in every town in all of the land. Not in every town, but go walk up to every farm and also blow that ram's horn, the ram's horn of the Jubilee. Yeah. This is our call. To blow the ram's horn, to proclaim that people can be free from the brokenness and the hurt of our world. This ram's horn represents where all people experience a wiping away of their debts, a forgiveness of their debts, their forgiveness of their sins, right? Isn't this something that also Jesus practiced? All the time. He went places. He showed up. It turned out there was some guy who was unclean that people said he had a lot of debt over his head, whether it's spiritual debt or financial debt or whatever debt. And Jesus said, I don't care what kind of debt you got. We're going to say, I forgive you. You have received the forgiveness of sins, and you are restored to freedom in my society. That was the message of Jesus wherever he went, to everyone he found, especially those who had debts over their heads. In the ancient Near East, people were in slavery more frequently than not for economic reasons. That there was a huge money pound over their head that says, for this reason, you have to be in debt. And the crazy, radical part of Exodus 25 is it says that people should not be in debt anymore. People should not be in debt when they are in relationship with God. That God's will for people's lives is for that debt to be forgiven. And that they can be set free. Now, one thing you will also notice, which is I think this is the part where we get hung up a lot, is if you look at this text, you'll see in verses 4 through 6 and 11 through 12, you'll see that like it has these like really repetitive verses that say, in a very what could be said in very few words, which is, don't work. It says it like three times in a row, rearranged in different syntactical ways. Well, one of the interesting things about systems of idolatry of any kind is systems of idolatry try and keep you to work. They try and keep you going and keep you working, right? And part of the secret for even for us as the people of God is that we have to follow that commandment to rest and not work. Rest and not work. We have to pause, take the time to see how the Spirit of God is moving. Be personally revitalized by God. If you want to do something for this set-free movement stuff, if you want to do something with this set-free stuff, you have to personally choose to be revitalized by God, to rest in God's holiness in your life. And that is one of the most important and first crucial steps. Frequently, there are people in our culture who are so busy working and doing stuff that they completely miss that God might even be there or God might even be doing something. How often have we missed that the Spirit of God is working because we're so busy working and chomping away, right? This is a huge problem. We work ourselves too hard to not see or experience what the Spirit of God is doing. This work-rest thing is a big tip-off for all of us to show us if there is some kind of bondage going on or some kind of idol in the dark going on. If something just keeps us working or keeps another person working in perpetuity, only believe in 6 days a week, then we can clearly see that there is some kind of idol in the dark that's happening. But it's the sound of Jubilee that calls us to go for it, that brings us freedom, and that has the power to bring others freedom. Do you believe in this sound of Jubilee? What does it sound like to you? That you hear a happiness in your soul and in your heart, do you not? A gentle warmth, even on the coldest night. This is the freedom we can give people. It's the greatest spiritual freedom at all. This Jubilee isn't something that's far away in the clouds. It's not a hope that's distant. It's a hope that's present. It is the nearness of the kingdom of God. It is the living experience of salvation we have in our lives. It is a living connection with God we can have in every moment of every day. That is the Jubilee sound we offer unto others, to be connected to our Creator. Where does the ram's horn need to blow in your life? Where can you carry the message of the ram's horn? Where can you carry the message of the Jubilee? Something that Kevin Austin says, he's the leader of the Set Free movement. He says, whatever you go, whatever you do, wherever you go, do it in the direction of freedom. What do you like to do? What is who you are? Can you do that in the direction of freedom? Can you do that in the direction of the Jubilee? That is something that we believe at this church, that we love God, that we love people, that we serve joyfully, and that we do all of it in the direction of freedom. Amen.